Want your business to have the best opportunity for success? Take a tip from tech industry leader Intel when you move or expand in Ohio. The new Silicon Heartland is the place forward-thinking business leaders find ample talent, a highly ranked business climate, convenient central location, plus an especially low-risk environment for site selection. Where else can you have all the room you need to grow while rubbing elbows with the giants in your industry? Visit successinohio.com today.
That cold case you're listening to? Nasty stuff. But you know what else is a crime? Missing even a moment of whatever you're doing to go on a drink run. Luckily, there's Drizly, the number one app for alcohol delivery. With Drizly, you can compare prices on the biggest selection of beer, wine, and spirits, then get them delivered in under 60 minutes. So download the Drizly app or go to drizly.com. That's drizly.com today.
Hello, all you fine people out there. Thank you for checking out the Performance Anxiety Podcast on the Pantheon Podcast Network. I'm your host, Mark, and my guests today are Deborah Bonham and Peter Bullock of Bonham Bullock. We talk about their musical histories, including the influence Deborah's brother, the legendary John Bonham, had on her life. Deborah explains the 16-year gap between her first two albums, working with Paul Rodgers, and Robert Plant's continual guidance. In fact, his ringtone on Deborah's phone is Cashmere, by the way. They tell me how they started both their personal and professional relationships, and they also tell me how they became Paul Rodgers' band for his Free Spirit tour, and how Peter found himself at Led Zeppelin's secret reunion rehearsals. Their new album of interpretations spans 7 decades of music. Pick it up now in all the usual places. Follow Peter, Deborah, and the band on all the social media platforms. Follow us at Performance ANX there as well. You show us some support with a review or a cup of coffee on ko-fi.com/performanceanxiety. Merch is available at performanceanx.threadless.com. And now let's get right into it with Deborah Bonham and Peter Bullock on Performance Anxiety on the Pantheon Podcast Network.
This
is Peter Bullock.
And this is Deborah Bonham. This is Deborah Bonham.
Who?
Can we just do it now, please? Stop it. Okay. I'm Deborah Bonham, and this is...
Peter Bullock.
We have a new album coming out called Bonham Bullock on Porto Valley Records. We're still going to be here next week if he doesn't shut up. Now, come on, pay attention. When you got thrown out of school, you're hopeless. Pay attention. That's why I did so well at school.
I know. Peter has trouble paying attention.
Get away. Okay, let's do this now, okay?
Peter has trouble paying for beer.
Hey, come on. Yeah, we're supposed to be going to the pub as well, so come on.
Oh,
yeah.
This is Bob. Thank you. Thank you very much for tuning in. I'm not Johnny O'Connor. See ya!
The magic word. Okay, go on then. Hi, I'm Deborah Bonham.
I'm Peter Bullock, and we've got a new album, Bonham Bullock, coming at you through the airwaves. So
on Quarter Valley Records, and you're listening to us on Performance Anxiety Podcast.
Is it just you, or is Peter going to be joining in later?
Peter is going to join in. Okay, I'll just shout him, hey! We've had a bit of a morning racing around, so we've just managed to... jump in the shower and run to this. And it's like, oh my God, it's running. The password didn't work because I wasn't typing it in properly, you know. It's like, whoa. And then I noticed it said anxiety podcast. And yes. I thought, yeah, we're all like this.
Yeah, I've gotten a lot of comments on that one.
Here you go, Pete.
Well, hello.
Hey. Oh, all right.
Mark, Why have you got a guitar with you?
I'm putting it on the roof.
It's been...
on the roof of what?
Oh,
on the roof of what?
The roof of the house while the scaffold's up.
I don't understand.
I'm going to do it. We've got some scaffold up on our roof where our chimney fell down in the storm.
Oh,
so I'm going up there. So I'm going up there for a pose with the guitar.
Oh, nice. That is gorgeous. Oh, I'm jealous.
It's all been going on this morning. The what? Regular quiet Sunday morning in our house, not.
Oh, God. Man, I woke up and just ran through the album one more time, took some more notes, and that's been my morning. So I get a little calmer than yours, it sounds like.
Yeah.
Well, I hope we didn't ruin your morning for you.
Not at all. I like starting it off that way. It's a little anxiety building for me whenever I get, no matter who I'm listening to, because I'm always, I try to do as much research as I can. And then I would just sit there and I'm like, I know I'm missing something that I wanted to talk about. I know it. I make myself anxious doing this stupid podcast. So.
Hence the name, Performance Anxiety Podcast.
Yeah, exactly. It's basically my anxiety and not having anything to do with my guests. So
just couldn't even get the password in correctly. You kept saying incorrect password. I was getting myself
So that was a little deliberate trick there on your part, wasn't it, Mark?
No, it was my bad typing, not capitals and non-capitals.
Let's get the audience really anxious and give them the wrong password.
Yeah. Exactly. That's the plan. I'm just going to take one of the password letters. I'm going to switch it from caps to lowercase, and then you guys got to figure it out. That's going to be my new plan from now on. Thanks, Peter.
Don't listen to him. You will only end up in bad ways. Let me tell you that, Mark. Yeah. Do not listen to this man. You will end up in a bad way.
Oh.
Take it from me. It happened to me. Tell you.
Hey, but hell, in a bad place to be.
No, hey, it's been what, 30 years? 32 years? 31, 32 years?
31 years, yeah.
Of hell.
Yeah.
You've been hell. I've been an absolute angel.
She's an absolute angel.
My wife would say the same thing. We're 20, we'll be married 21 this year, 22 together. So
we're the same, aren't we?
Yeah.
We're the same, 21 years married.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on that. Well, the way I like to start things off usually is finding out about and talking about your backgrounds and how you got into music to get to where you are right now. So, So a lot of these questions I'm going to ask, it's going to be for both of you to answer. So, don't. Just chime in however you want. I will start off with the obvious. Deborah, you have an amazingly creatively talented family. I mean, obviously your brother John, one of the greatest drummers of all time. You also had a brother Michael who was a very talented photographer and DJ. Was there a lot of creativity in the house? Were your parents doing a lot of creative things with you guys, with music, art?
No, I mean, my dad was a master craftsman, a master builder, but his big thing was woodwork. So he was very creative with woodwork, definitely. And he was a master at it. My mom wanted to be a comedy musical star in her 20s. But she always wanted to do that. But she never did. She got married and had the kids, She made her first album when she was 80.
Whoa.
She joined a band when she was 80 called the Zimmers.
Oh, that is awesome.
we took her to a studio and she recorded Let It Be, and we were rocking. Let it be. And she, so she always had that in her,
That is amazing.
But besides that, it was really, they always played great music, from the very as early as I can remember, and certainly for John when he was growing up, before I was born, because I'm 14 years younger than him.
Right.
And 12 years younger than Michael. So they were very close. So when they were growing up, Mom and Dad were always playing things like Benny Goodman and Glenn Miller. So the big bands, but all the blues stuff as well. Okay. There was a lot of Sarah Vaughan and Billie Holiday and all of that sort of stuff. So so they grew up with that, listening to that sort of music. And I did too. So I guess, yeah, music was always in there.
Okay.
My mom was a Frank Sinatra fan, my dad, Lena Horne, and all of those as well. So, you know, it was a constant thing. So I guess, yeah, there was that sort of creativity, but they weren't particularly musical themselves until, of course, Mom was 80. And then she did her, you know, before her life ended, she had one little go.
Oh, is that available anywhere, or is that just for the family?
Oh, yeah. No, it's available.
It was on release, and... I'm wondering if I'm gonna do a little search. It must be able to stream it because they did release the album, so it will be out there. Yeah. I can send you a link afterwards.
And I think it was all done for something like Alzheimer's or you know,
age concern.
It was done for the charity Age Concern.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Without a healthy mind, being truly happy and at peace is hard. The good news is, therapy works. But what is therapy exactly? It's whatever you want it to be. Maybe you're not feeling motivated right now and would like some tools to help. Or maybe you're feeling insecure in relationships or at work, not dealing well with the stress. Whatever you need, it's time to stop being ashamed of normal human struggles and start feeling better because you deserve to be happy. And now you don't have to worry about finding an in-person therapist near you to help. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. Try doing that in person. So join the millions of people who are seeing what online therapy is really about. It's always a good time to invest in yourself because you are your greatest asset. And a special offer to Performance Anxiety listeners, you can get 10% off your first month of professional therapy at betterhelp.com/performanceanxiety. That's betterhelp.com/performanceanxiety. Thanks again to BetterHelp for sponsoring this podcast.
There was, quite a few of them. And they were all ranged between 70 and I think the eldest was about 90.
Wow.
They got a bit of, you know, they got some headlines in the press.
Of course, nowadays, real rock stars are 70, aren't they?
Yeah. I know. That's very funny. I know.
She could have been the opening act for the Rolling Stones upcoming tour.
Yeah. Well, youngsters opening up.
Yeah,
the Stones.
Exactly. Here's an upstart band.
She didn't, you know, she wasn't going to do it. And I said to her, you've wanted to sing all your life. So here's your chance. Aww. So come on. So we went in the studio and I held her hand and she sang at the mic, you know, and it was great. Yeah. It was lovely. She became a diva after that, didn't she? And there was no living with her, I tell you.
Although she did get me the gig of the guitar solo on the song.
She did.
She told the producer, I want my PT to do the solo for this.
I want my PT on the solo. Yeah.
But it's great because Let It Be is a great guitar solo, isn't it? From the original Beatles solo. It was a beautiful melodic guitar solo, which I grew up with anyway. So that was great fun to play.
That is awesome. Oh, so Peter, how did you
did it pretty much like George Harrison. So it's like, No need to change it. It was great as it was.
Exactly. You don't have to embellish too much with that. So,
yeah.
So Peter, what about you? How did you get into music? Was there a lot of it growing up in your household?
It was like the old vinyl singles lying around that were my mother's and things like that. And then babysitters, you know, my parents would go out a couple of times a week and in would come an aunt, you know, like a younger, my mum's younger sisters or younger brother, who's my uncle, 3 years older than me. So we started exploring all their old records because we didn't have any of our own. So it was everything from the Beatles, the Stones, and even Roy Orbison, and Duane Eddy, and the Shadows, and the one that sort of got me with it, like the Three and Bad Company, whenever they had those kind of things.
Oh yeah.
And then we were, and then we got our first guitars when I was about 8 years old. And
you say we?
Sorry,
you,
my Uncle Paul.
Yeah, you got to talk about Uncle Paul. he sadly passed away, but
he died about 3 years ago.
He's only a couple of years older than Pete, so a bit like Jason and myself.
So we got guitars, and we'd copy the records on our guitars and work them out, and he'd help me work the stuff out. So it's just playing the record, you know, putting the needle back on again, listen to it again, then back on again, then just for the guitar solo a bit, then trying to copy. So years of that as a child, it was good fun.
That's a real effort. Yeah, it's a real effort to do that. You got to be dedicated. You can't just, you know, go to Google and pull up some tabs and look at it.
Yeah, but now that you couldn't do any of that, you had to do it all yourself. You had to work it out for yourself.
Yeah, that's some dedication.
See, yeah, but it meant you. But the thing was, if you're rubbish at football and you didn't get picked for the team, you just won't play guitar.
You know? There you go.
So, Demet, was singing always your forte, or did you try to pick up an instrument at any point?
No, it was always singing.
Okay.
Singing. I mean, I sort of, I can sort of find my way around a keyboard in chords when I'm writing my songs.
Yes.
And just about, I can't do bar chords. My fingers just won't do a bar chord on a guitar. So I've got the regular, and I find a note and the two couple of notes, I say to Pete, what's that chord, you know? So, you know, I do it by ear. I'm not very good at all. And occasionally I have to play live on stage on acoustic on some of the songs. I dread it. I feel it's the performance anxiety, you see.
Yep.
I know the song coming up and I've got to put this damn guitar on. And I'm like, oh no. It's okay.
It's everybody.
It's always been singing. Yeah. Even when I was little, we had a reel to reel that you could record on. And I just kept playing Chuck Berry's My Dingling, and I used to sing it into the, I know, I used to sing it. I'd forgotten about this. I remembered it the other day, it triggered a memory. There was that and the Raggle Taggle Gypsies. I used to play that. Oh, that was a great song, the Raggle Taggle Gypsies.
Go on, sing it.
No, I'm not going. The Raggle Taggle Gypsies.
Interpret it.
Anyway, so I was about...
That was done with respect, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It's an old folk rhyme thing, you know. So that was about when I was six years old, and I had this...
Oh, folk, sorry.
Folk.
Sorry.
You know, my dad had got me this, I think. Well, I think it was Michael's, actually, my brother's. And So I've always been singing. Always. And then at school, I just naturally progressed, and I used to represent the school and do competitions, and then ended up doing a bit of opera and this, that, and the other.
So it was a folk off by this stage.
You know, this is what I live with. It's just...
Non-stop
I don't
chuckles.
I need to folk off in a minute.
So, all right, so Debbie, Peter talked about some of his influences. You know, you were, what, four when John started playing with a band of Joy and Tim Rose and all, or so, and six when Zeppelin formed?
Yeah.
So was that, did that creep in, or was that like, oh, that's my brother's thing, I don't want to, I'm not going to bother with that, or was his music, like Zeppelin and Band of Joy and all that, was that an influence on you?
Oh, wow, yeah. I mean, I used to have my little girlfriends when I was about seven or eight come round to the house, and I used to put on Dazed and Confused.
And when it seven or eight?
I used to go, right, dance now, and we'd all be going, da, 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 da. They hadn't got a clue who this man was, you know. So, yeah, oh, crikey, yeah. I mean, I drive him mad with it. I am, you know, I'm a huge Zeppelin fan, of course I am. Yeah. I mean, I'm just very lucky that I always say this, that, you know, my brother was just the greatest, and Led Zeppelin. I mean, he could have been in a real rubbish band, and what would that have been like?
he could have stayed with Tim Rose.
He could have been a drummer in an absolute pants band, and you know,
Tiny Tim.
It was Led Zeppelin.
And a drummer in Tiptoe Through the Tulips.
Did he ever have a drummer?
See, I can't even.
You know, you can imagine that. It's like, it's a... So I was incredibly fortunate that, you know, he really was incredible. And the band were just phenomenal. And I have loved them from the minute I heard them. So, yeah, of course, it's crept in. It's been my marker all the way through my life, I guess, you know. They set the bar so high that, you know, I always measure what we're doing. You know, I don't compare. I don't even try to get to that level. But I always think that's the marker, and that's what you've got to try to achieve. That's that brilliance of music and that brilliance of musicianship. And we're still working on it with Pete, but we're getting there.
Oh man, I see how this is going to go. All right.
It's a feisty Sunday morning.
You've already had your chimney fall down.
I'm a master of sitting at the bar.
You
setting the bar. Oh, right. Not sitting at the bar.
You do sit at the bar well.
Both. As long as there's a bar involved, I'm good.
Yeah.
I don't mind. Did either of you take lessons growing up for guitar or singing?
I had vocal coaching, definitely, when I was in, you know, sort of like 13 onwards.
Okay.
I had a teacher called Mrs. Pullen at school, and she was fantastic. She taught me to sing from the diaphragm instead of at the throat.
I never understood that. That every singer I've had says something like that, and I'm like, I don't even know where the hell that is. What am I?
It's just coming from that. Yeah. I mean, it's a weird thing. And, you know, it's, I think you either can do it or
you're me.
I don't even know if it's something that can be taught, but what she would do with me was various exercises when I was young. So I sort of learned how to deep it down, you know, and find that space.
Okay.
She was great. And she wasn't a specialist. It was just the music teacher at our school, but she took a particular interest in me, which was great. She was so lovely to me. And I loved it. I love singing. So I used to do, you know, like lunchtimes, I'd go and have a lesson with her, you know, or we'd do some stuff. And it was all opera, which was quite funny.
Oh, wow.
I know. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. But, you know, rock and roll was always in my heart and spirit. So
it's in your family.
You know.
So Peter, what about you? Did you end up taking lessons, or are you self-taught?
No, I never took any lessons, and apparently it can be heard in my style.
I was waiting for it.
No, you know what? It's great that you didn't.
I can see the wheels turning.
Yeah, like, oh, no, I was like, I avoided lessons of any sort for anything, whether it was music or
and education. It's not just you can't teach feel, you see.
No, exactly.
You can't. You can teach all the chords, and you can get players that are absolutely spot on, and the notes and everything is great. But if you haven't got the soul there, whereas P can play one note and it just gets you.
Yeah.
And you can't, that isn't, you can't teach that. That's got to come from inside somewhere, you know.
So yeah.
I'm not sure about being formally taught as a guitarist would be a bit odd, wouldn't it?
You're in danger of sounding like your teacher.
Yeah. I mean, it does help to know a few of the chords, I guess. I could have done a bit of help.
Let me just do some, you know, the stress chicken foot and all that kind of stuff. And all these. Yeah, we give them all sorts of names. Anyway. I mean, the police are still trying to teach me how to drive under the speed limit. So, I mean, I just don't recall anything.
I know that one, too. Yeah. So when did you guys...
Yeah.
How old were you guys when you started gigging and playing out in front of people?
Well, for me, it was about 13 years old.
Wow.
There'd be a school disco every couple of months or something on a Friday night. And,
school disco.
Yeah, no, school disco. And we'd persuade them to give us a band slot, you know, so we'd... and of course, that would have been about 1977. So the punk was starting to creep in as well. So we didn't separate music. We were going straight from like heavy rock, blues, and including punk as well, because we had quite a punk movement with bands like Stiff Little Fingers and The Undertones and Teenage Kicks and all that kind of stuff. So we'd throw Teenage Kicks right in there with Black Sabbath, Paranoid.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
And then and then followed by Smoke and Water, then Suspect Device by the Stiff Little Fingers, and then Sex Pistols, and then back to another Deep Purple song or another. We had no idea that you were supposed to group music into some sort of category. So we were just Hendrix to the Pistols to anything goes.
Yeah. It's just whatever hit you.
That's quite cool.
Yeah.
So Deborah, how about you? When did you start playing out in front of people live and in person?
Older than that. I mean, I didn't really start going into my own music and, you know, away from school. I stayed on at school till 18. And so it wasn't just after, it was probably just after John had passed away, because he passed away when I was 18. So it was a little bit after that, I'm guessing.
Okay.
And yeah, I was, Jason and I got together and we went over to Robert Plant's, because he lived in the next sort of village, and we went over to his little studio in his barn and had a go, because I just said, I just want to have a go to see if I, you know, I can do this. And and it was him who basically said, you know, you need to get out and, you know, pay your dues, really, get on the stage. So we put a band together, and Jason then went off to do his motocross, because he was very young then. He was about 14, 15.
Oh, wow.
15. He was about 15, yeah. So he decided he wasn't going to quite, he didn't want to join the band at that point, which was fine. And so I got together with another, you know, a few local people in around our village, and off we went, started playing gigs, and that was it. And then it just progressed and progressed. And then I met Pete at a wedding. I was a friend of the groom. He was a friend of the bride. And he was the band for the wedding party. That was their gift to the bride.
Oh, awesome.
And the groom said to me, you know, he was from New York. And he said, you know, Deb, are you gonna get out and sing with them? And I went, well, you know, if the band are okay, you know, yeah, okay with me doing that.
Yeah.
So I got up and that was it, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That was the end of that. So. Goodbye, freedom.
Yeah. Was that avenue you were closed off?
It was. It was totally closed off for you from that moment on, wasn't it?
So, Deborah, was it?
I had to start playing the right notes after that.
Yeah.
I'm getting away with playing whatever I wanted up until then.
Hey, yep. It's all over after that.
Yeah. And honestly, that was it. It really was 31 years ago, and we've been together 24/7 ever since. So,
was there any concern about going into music as a profession from your family after John's passing?
Oh, crikey, yeah. I mean, there was concern before John passed.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember talking to him about it, and he really wasn't best pleased with me, you know. I said, well, I really want to be a singer, you know. And he was like, no. He wanted me to... Mom and dad and my brother Michael and John, I mean, they all just wanted me to do well at school, which was great, because they were right, you know, that was a good thing to do.
Yeah.
But John had seen quite an unsavory side of the business, you know, and it wasn't a great place for women back then. I mean, it really wasn't.
No.
It was damn tough. I was about to watch it last night, but I'm going to watch it tonight. I didn't have time last night, but there's a film out about Helen Reddy. And the misogyny that she came up against back in the 60s, you know, and it, really in the 70s, it was still there. I mean, it was, and when I did my first album in the 80s, it was really tough. I mean, it wasn't great for women. It was hard. And I think John knew that, because he knew Maggie Bell really well, who's one of my absolute vocal heroes with the Stoner Crows, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And Maggie went on. She went on to sign with Swan Song, which was the Led Zeppelin label, and make a phenomenal album. Suicide Cell was just absolutely one of the greatest albums for me growing up.
Great album. Check that one out.
Oh, great, yeah. Album. Really great. She was just... And she was winning, you know, she was the female vocalist in the UK, winning awards, you know. She was at the Zeppelin at the awards for the Melody Maker. And I've had long talks with her about, you know, exactly what it was like for her back then.
Oh,
and
wow.
It wasn't pretty. So John knew. So John was really like, I don't think you should do this. I think he thought I was going to be a vet or a lawyer. Probably, you know, that would have been a good, we've got so many animals that being a vet might have been a good idea.
Is that one reason why you waited so long to do an album and wait till 85?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I wasn't sure. And then when he died, the world fell apart, you know. So, I was lost for quite a while. The whole family was totally in a dark place. So, you know, I didn't naturally just go, I'm going to go and do this. But you can't, you know, you can't hold down what's in you. It's in me and it always has been. And so it was obvious that I was eventually going to find my way somehow. But it's been a tough path, you know, a real tough path. Because to find your way, A, as a woman, and B, as the sister of one of the greatest living drummers in one of the greatest bands of all time, is not an easy thing to do. And to want to do it your way and not keep being told, you know. I mean, I had so many offers to do like a Led Zeppelin covers band record labels wanting me to do Led Zeppelin songs and, you know, in a disco version, all this. And I was just inundated with this crap. And
disco version wasn't my idea. No.
The Irish disco version.
I just thought, you know, it was hard carving the path. And, you know, at this late stage now, I feel I've eventually got there.
Yeah.
You know, I've really, really made the album I wanted to make, and I've produced the album I wanted to produce with the band I want to play in. And I think that it's been a rough road, but it's been a great road. You know, I'm glad it went that way.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors.
How was the experience making your first album? Did you get any advice? I mean, it sounds like, you know, you've been friends with Robert Plant for years, but when For You and the Moon came out, did he have advice for you? Did any of the other members reach out or anything?
No. I went and did it. I did it on my own. I mean, Robert did say to me in the beginning, you know, what are you going to do if you want to go and do this? What are you going to do about the name? And I went, what do you mean about the name? He said, I think you're going to come up against some problems. And of course, he was right. Absolutely. Yeah. On the money. But I just felt it's my name and it will come out. Even if I change it, it's going to come out. And I'm proud of my name. You know, I'm so proud of what John achieved and what Led Zeppelin achieved.
Of course, yeah.
But it's also my dad's name, my parents and my grandparents, you know. And if I can't do that name proud myself, if I can't come up to the mark, so to speak, then I've got no right being in the industry anyway. So I just thought, well, it's down to me to prove that I can do this. So I did send out the original demos anonymously.
Okay.
And then I got the deal based on that. You know, I got a phone call and I got the career deal anonymously.
Wow.
But of course, once it came to the contracts and everything, of course it came out. It had to come out.
Yeah.
And then it would all go a bit pear-shaped. And, you know, it just all became about that. And of course it was always going to. So now, later on in my life now, I've realized that, that's there. It's a part of me. Led Zeppelin and John are a big part of me, but it's not all of me.
Right.
But now I can embrace it and talk about it and it's fine. But then it just got, everybody always wanted to keep knowing the bad, you know, all those tiresome stories that have just been done to death over all the years.
Exactly.
So I did find it difficult, but
I'll tell you what though, I was able to track down the song Hungry Night. Okay, so that's really wild because it sounds like it could be off of like one of Robert Plant's early albums, you know, like Shaken and Stirred.
Mine was first.
But then you've got this crazy ass guitar solo.
No, it wasn't.
Oh, just can we make it that mine was first? I'm going to rewrite history here.
There you go. Hey, that's what podcasts are all about. But the song, it's got this, it sounds like a mid-80s album, you know. It's got the guitar sound. It sounds like maybe like Robbie Blunt or somebody playing guitar. It's got that tone to it. But then this wild ass distorted crazy guitar solo comes in. It's so wild. I love that kind of stuff.
Yeah, honest, Mark, that it's not a great deal to do with me on that album. I mean, the record company basically took me out to Germany and...
But you wrote half the songs.
Yeah, but I didn't really, you know... They were written very differently to how they ended up. It was all produced by a guy called Reiner Pertner, who's a great guy, you know, really, really good guy. And there was Tony Carey from
Rainbow. Richie Blackmore's Rainbow.
He had some sort of part ownership of the studio that we were at, so he got involved as well. He was a great guy. I mean, he's an amazing musician. But I didn't really, I was like a bit of a fish out of water because I was very much, my songs were sort of a bit folky, a bit Joni Mitchell cross, going into a bit of Fleetwood Mac. It was all around that sort of, you know, but it was all a bit rooted, I was always rooted in blues, but I sort of was a little bit more ethereal, I guess. And then it turned into 80s rock, you know. What?
Wait, you know, so, that's making a comeback. Maybe you should re-release the album.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe. maybe. Not just yet. I'm on a path of this album at the moment.
Right. Okay. Yeah. We'll,
long ago.
Good
and
point.
I hated the cover. I just damn well hated the blessed cover of it. That photograph of me. I mean, all. Pouting and hair, and it just wasn't me, you know. It was like, crikey, it was like I'd been airbrushed in the studio backstage. They did all the makeup, they did the hair, and when I looked at myself, I went, oh, good grief, who's that?
You That's know? How she was when I met her.
It just wasn't me. It was like, oh, okay.
I think it's all right.
Yeah.
And it got great reviews. I mean, the album got great reviews, but... Yeah, it wasn't my heart and soul, you know. It's not very often I play
funny,
that album and go,
enough,
yeah.
That album's actually very popular in South America for some reason.
It's wow.
Yeah, you can see all the statistics that you get
on the air tonight.
Stuff.
Yeah.
On the air tonight. And Hungry Night always gets played.
Three or four of those songs from that album are still being played in Brazil and where else was it? Did I see it in Chile and Paraguay or something?
Yeah.
Just generally South America loves that.
That is awesome. Man, it's like I'm trying to become the biggest podcast in Croatia, but I'm like not quite there yet.
Okay, so. We'll play for you in the moon, and you might get there. Can we just stick with the new album, Bon and Bullock album? That's the one I love.
Actually, a couple of years ago, we threw in the title track for You and the Moon. We did it in our live set. We did a bit of a reworking of it.
Do you know I don't mind doing that? Actually, maybe we'll put that back.
Yeah,
that is awesome. Like that. So, Peter, how did you get into it professionally?
Well, I started playing from about 13, probably.
You're still waiting, actually.
And then I retired. I retired when I was about 16. Whenever
he's hoping this is the time. He's going to be professional.
Yeah,
aren't
well, yeah. By the age of about 16, I realized that guitars would attract women and beer, so I gave up the guitar. In about 5 years of women, beer, and motorbikes, and then fell into the guitar again.
Wow.
And just got it. Some bands asked me to, I know somebody left and said, oh, Pete, are you still? Oh, yeah, all right. And so I moved to London by this stage at about 21 years old. And the area I moved to was incredibly musical. It was a place called Maida Vale in London. And everybody in every street was members of Yes, Barclay James Harvest, AC/DC, a load of glam bands from the British scene, Mud Street. Glenn Matlock from Sex Pistols, Andy from Depeche Mode lived next door, Frankie Miller. It was just ridiculous. Everybody, Ozzy Osbourne had the house opposite. It was incredible. So you go to this bar and you would you just meet people. And plus, as well as the artists, the place was full of crew guys as well. So I shared a flat with a guy, that Toby, who had just done the sign for the 90125 Yes tour. He'd have the Sony Walkman with like two headphone sockets, and we'd go to bed at night after being at the bar listening to the live concert from 90125.
Oh wow.
And then all that crew and stuff. So we were always
pretty happening.
We were always like either in a band or doing a gig or hanging out with people, or if you weren't playing, you would get to go off on a tour and help some other band for a little tour or something. So it was always revolved around that. It was quite a It's quite a hoot.
That sounds fascinating. Oh, man. Sounds like a blast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there is a...
blast, I think.
Now, there's quite a gap between For You and the Moon and The Old Hyde. What was going on in that time frame? Because that's what, like 16 years or so between albums?
I got caught up a little bit in record company politics.
It was probably 10 years, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was 10 years.
You're right, 16 years. But by 10 years' time, we'd started to make The Old Hyde and we'd started the band up again and stuff. So.
Yeah, and there was one single that came out in 95, I think, right?
Yeah, Perfect World.
Perfect World.
It was just, I was caught up in it a bit. I was contractually tied up and there was a few things. Then the company disappeared. Career Records went into administration, I think, and it was all messy. It was just messy.
Yeah.
And so there wasn't really much I could do and I couldn't really go.
There'd been a couple of record offers with, was it Geffen, I think?
Yeah.
And then it was, and then they found out that they were still tied to the old Carrere contract. So
all the music was tied up. And so, you know, nobody wanted to go down that road of trying to get all, it was a real mess. It was just a mess. And it was my own fault for, you know, in the beginning, thinking I'm going to do this myself. And if I'd have gone to, you know, the right people in the beginning, I probably wouldn't have signed all that. But anyway, I did. And it was a mess.
Yeah.
So it was okay. Well, you know, when the realization was that I really wasn't going to get another record deal, I thought I've got to try and figure this out myself. And I just started working in the industry.
Okay.
And worked for lots of different record companies in different departments. And I ended up in the working for a great guy, Fran Neverkler, but he was at Warner Brothers at the time. And he was doing all the contracts for a lot of the big artists. And so I would be working on those contracts. And I learned a lot about contracts then. And that's when I was able to revisit everything and get myself out. It took a long time for me to learn it, and it was a natural. It wasn't bad. It was a great thing for me. It was cathartic, you know. I grew because I had to get out there and dig deep in there. You know, I had to make a living, and all of a sudden, things were falling apart. And when your back's against the wall, you've got to come out and you've got to fight. You know, It made me grow up really quickly.
Wow.
Because seriously, I did come into this business with rose-colored glasses. You know, I was so naive. I just thought, because all I'd ever known was John turning up with, you know, another album that had gone to number one. And I just thought, okay, you become a musician, you make an album, it goes to number one. That's how naive I was.
Wow. And,
it's anything but that, you know. Anything but that. And so I had to wise up.
Yeah.
And I think if things had taken off for me with For You and the Moon, I don't think it would have been a good outcome for me in the end. I think the whole thing about it all falling apart and having to get out there and work and having to pay my dues and learn the industry, I think was probably one of the best things that could have ever happened for me. So, I don't look back and think, oh, what a shame, or how bad that was. No, I think it was great. So I took that time to learn. And then we did the album and we managed to get some money together and we made The Old Hyde, didn't we?
Yeah.
Before that, we went on tour with, I'd already written the album, but we went on tour with my nephew Jason in America. We were opening up for him, weren't we?
Yeah, we did about 22 dates. Started off 97 or 96. And we started off at the House of Blues in Los Angeles.
Oh, wow.
And it was a fabulous introduction to American touring because it was a lovely venue and stuff. Yep. And then he had Slash guesting on guitar as well. So we got it was a good, great old hangout, and the Counting Crows turned up and stuff. So it was quite a sort of glamorous introduction for us into like the American way, and a big party afterwards. And Terry Reid was there, great singer.
Oh, I love Terry Reid.
He became a great friend of ours, and uh, And I remember that the manager saying to us, that was the first date of this tour. The manager saying about two in the morning, he says, oh, come on, you guys, you've got to get into the bus. We've got to drive overnight to the next show. Okay, we've had a great time. Go, 22 of these. Can't wait. We woke up in Reno, Nevada.
Oh, my
with,
Lord.
With chicken wire in front of the stage.
Oh, the old Bob's Country Bunker.
Yeah, so it was all downhill from there.
Yeah. it was still great, you know. But what we were doing the songs off the old Hyde album because we'd just written them.
Yeah.
We hadn't exactly made the album. We hadn't made it then, but they'd been written. So we were doing these songs. They were going down a storm, really were going down a storm. And eventually there was a couple of record labels there, wasn't there?
Well, Sony.
Sony was there. And they saw the crowd going mad, and we had some little made-up discs, you know, just that we could sell on the tour, and there was queues and queues of people. And we thought, we've cracked it. We've cracked this, so we're going to get this deal. And
we saw the facsimile that the Sony rep had sent to the office, you know, on Sony headed paper, and it says never mind Sister of John Bonham. She sounds more like the sister of Steve Marriott or Paul Rodgers.
God, wow. I forgot about that. Yeah.
We still got that somewhere. Said, never mind John Bonham. She sounds more like the sister of Paul Rodgers or Steve Marriott. And
that's awesome.
That's a pretty cool.
Well, it was. I remember. So we thought, this is going to work, you know. And then they said, girl, you know, we'd like to meet you. Let's have a talk about this. We ended up in Los Angeles again, and we met up at this Beverly Hills hotel somewhere. And I'm thinking, great, all the new songs, you know, we're going to make this new album. And they sat there and went, now, what we think is we want you to do a Lady Sings the Blues type of album. Covers of Billie Holiday and this, that, and the other. And I remember somebody saying, because you know Spring Chicken or something. I mean, that was 30 years ago. God help me now.
But
25 years ago.
Damn.
So, back then, once you were over 30, you were old and on the shelf.
Yeah, I was only about, adult.
Nobody realised that you'd still be sort of touring and rocking at 70 years old.
Like, I'm not Stones 70.
No, but that shows we've got 30 years
what
to go.
What like? That
was but everybody else is out there in their 70s.
You won't be if you carry on at this rate. Yeah. And so, they just said, well, you know, there's a thing that, you know, we obviously saw you and we love what you've done, but we got to figure out how we're going to sell you, you know, and we think we should do this album. And I'm just sitting there. I was floored because I've just seen our music really resonate with people. And so I just went, no. Actually,
we're still in touch with those two people. Those two people were friends of John Lappin who got you on the...
a great people. But I saw why they said it. But, you know, so they're sort of...
But 25 years on, we're doing the covers album now.
Yeah, because we're ready. Yeah, but that's ready.
So it's almost like, you know, 25 years later, they're all sitting there going, told you so.
Yeah.
I know. It's going down your own path. You have to go your own path. But the funny part was when they're sitting there saying all of this and they really think that this is going to be, you know, this is going to be great. They're talking about Grammy Awards and this. Aren't we going to have a Grammy and we'll get this? And Pete's sitting there going, yeah, this is great. I don't care what we do. This sounds great. And I'm going, no, I'm not doing this. I'm not doing this. He went, hold on a minute. I'm just going to take her outside and talk to her.
She said something about getting the, I don't know, was it folk? Something about the folk off?
So he went to the door and he's going, what's the matter with you? Why won't you do it? You want to do this? They really want to put money in there. And I'm going, because I don't want to. It's. I can't, at that point in my life, I could never have done justice to Billie Holiday. I just couldn't. I hadn't had enough pain at that point. You know, the 31 years...
I was willing to inflict it.
Yeah, 31 years I've had with them since. I'm ready to do
now
that.
Now you're ready.
I've got it now. But then I didn't have it. And so I just said, you know, I can't do it. I can't do Billie Holiday justice. I can't do Etta James justice. Not now. Yeah. And I've written this stuff. I've got to do this. And so off I went down that path again and dragged him with me, kicking and shouting. You know, he was like, no, you were making a mistake. Of course you can sing it. Of course you can. No. And it's got to, it has to, that's what I know.
If you're going to. Before those little sort of initials came out, it was more like FFS.
Yes, you did say FFS. The thing is, what I know about music, if you're going to convince somebody else, then you've got to be convinced of it yourself.
Oh, yeah.
So there's no halfway, house here. I couldn't just get up and if I sang a Billie Holiday song, which I could probably do my own interpretation of it now, but back then I would have cringed. I would have cringed at what I would have done because it wouldn't have been respectful enough for her. You know, if you're going to take these people on, to me, it's immensely important that you pay the right respect and you've got to believe it yourself that you've done the best possible version. And I knew I couldn't do that. Right. So if I can't convince myself, how am I going to convince anybody else? You know, that's what I thought. And whether that was probably one of the biggest mistakes I made as far as everybody else was concerned, it wasn't as far as I was concerned.
Okay.
So off we went with the old hide.
Well, and everybody else in the industry continued having a shallow relationship with their music and playing shit that they don't believe in.
But I can't do that. I just can't. I just can't do it. It's not in me.
Not us. We had to believe in it.
Exactly. Hey, you know, integrity.
Yeah, it is. I'm afraid.
Can't pay my bills with integrity.
And I just can't. Even as much as he wanted me to shake it off, I just couldn't.
So you've got Old Hide.
And the old hide, it stands. And the love that I knew, well, they are buried there. I will be waiting with my arms open wide for when I see them. When I see them again.
Duchess, Spirit have all come out, and you've got some amazing people on these albums. In it, you know, you've got Peter, but you've also got Robbie Blunt, Doug Boyle, Robbie McIntosh, Mick Fleetwood's on a song. One of my favorite people on the planet, BJ Cole. He's been on the new album. Oh, that is awesome.
He's a big friend. I think he's been on the, he's
he was on the
been
Spirit
on
the, album as well. So he's on three of our albums so far.
Wow.
Yeah, three albums, BJ. He's just...
And I think BJ got brought in possibly by Jerry Shirley, who was, you know, from Humble Pie drummer, and he's on the Duchess album with us. Yeah. Jerry was in our live touring band for about 7 years as well.
Okay.
And I think it might have been his idea to get BJ in, because BJ Cole played on early Humble Pie albums as well.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
So...
Well, we've done a Humble Pie cover on the old hide, Black Coffee. Black coffee, fresh, sweet, round and full of pot, nah, nah, nah. Hot, hot black coffee, babe. And that's where it's at, and I mean it. But when I got there, I don't know where. Said I got hung over before it came out. We did that, and that's how we got involved with Jerry Shirley.
Because we didn't know him then. He had heard that version.
Jason played drums on the whole of that album, which was Mick Fleetwood.
So that's why Jerry Shirley wanted to meet us, because he loved Debbie's version of Marriott doing Black Coffee.
Wow, that's awesome.
So, of course I was right to not do that blues album. Look what happened. happened.
Exactly.
Look what happened. The people that we
well, they are them. Blues albums. They're just blues rock albums that we wrote.
No, you know what I mean. It's right not to do that because look what happened. The old Hyde, Duchess, that's what we got involved with Paul Rogers and he did a duet with me. And
I'll tell you who else is on the Duchess album. That came out.
You did.
I can't name that because it's like, what did you think I said?
I thought you just said, I'll tell you who else is on the dick.
That's what I thought he said too.
Well, now comes the name. I'm not going to say it now in the same sentence because...
I'm your dick.
I can't say it now because that sounds so disrespectful to the guy. He's a legend. I go, oh, no. We'll have to talk about something else and I need to come back to this.
Okay, we'll do that. How about... So.
I can't stop.
So, how did you? So,
I'm having so much trouble with it. Oh,
all right. So let's get Paul Rogers into this conversation at the moment where we start. Let's get past Dick and talk about Paul Rogers. So, how did you guys meet up with Paul and get him involved in the album?
God, I can't talk. Oh, and you'll be glad about that. No, he's writing me notes here, putting lots of Zs, like he's going off to sleep because he's so bored with my story.
Oh, man, what's that? That doesn't say much about my hosting abilities.
Oh, dear.
You see, he needs some caffeine to keep up.
What? You're not getting your words out right, Pete.
Paul Rogers.
Yeah, because I know, Peter, you're a big fan of Free and Bad Company. So did you know him before you started working on Duchess?
Yes, we had. Duchess, I think we started working on about 2007.
Yeah, we'd already done the
we'd tour. We did a tour with Paul in 2004.
Okay.
So we were support tour in the UK with Paul Rogers. And so that's where we first really met and we got to know him. And he'd stand outside the stage and sort of watch us and sort of, he seemed to then realize there was some sort of kind of bit of a Free-like swagger. And, well, I've heard people sort of compare us to like the sort of the British blues rock kind of swagger of Humble Pie, Free, that kind of thing. So
right.
we've been sort of compared to that. So Paul saw it as well. So when it came, we got involved in a bunch of animal charities with him as well. Debbie's always been a big savior of creatures.
That's wonderful. Oh, and she's pointing at you, man.
Yes, to save me. And Paul's wife Cynthia, big on animal charities and stuff like that. So
Paul, and kids, we do a lot of animals.
So Paul and I sort of have to go along with it. So we go to all these sanctuaries and stuff and do all these things for raising funds for all these charities and stuff. And Debbie and Cynthia would be right in there talking, and me and Paul would be talking about songs and guitarists and singers.
Having a beer.
Paul was also, a big friend of my brother John's, because, of course, they signed to, Bad Company signed to Swan Song as well.
Yeah.
So, but I fleetingly saw him at the farm when I was very young, but I never ever met him,
Okay.
So 2004, we didn't even meet him for the first three shows. Because, I don't know, we just thought we'd better stay out of the way, We'd heard some stories from, his tour manager was a little bit, and don't walk past his dressing room and don't look him in the eye.
Yeah, no eye contact.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Okay. All that kind of stuff went on. Paul didn't know
He didn't know, bless him. I mean, and so we just kept right out of the way. And our dressing room was next door to him, but we had to go around the whole building to get to it because we weren't allowed to go past his dressing room.
Oh, my God.
The third show, we were in Birmingham, and I had a cashmere ringtone on my phone, and it started ringing, and it was Robert Plant, which made everybody hysterical. Robert said, you're playing in there with Paul. He said, I'm going to come along. So can you make sure that it's all sorted? And so I went and spoke to the agents and said, and whilst that was happening, Paul was obviously told about that, but Paul came to the side of the stage and watched us. And when I came off, he said, where have you been? This is like the third night and we've not met you or anything. And we went, well, we just thought we better keep out the way, Paul. And he was like, why? Come on. That's like, and that was it. And we became the closest of friends. And, you know, him and his wife, beautiful people.
Oh, wow.
But he had got this guy, these guys that were sort of telling us we couldn't do. And I guess I understand why, but they didn't realize the connection, you know,
yeah,
that we had. Oh. But it was funny. It was three nights, wasn't it? I mean, I still, you know, when we did the Duchess album, I still didn't feel confident enough to ask him about singing on it. And I think it was Cynthia who suggested, you know, if you're doing something, Paul would come and sing with you. I think that's how it worked out, because I would never have had the nerve to have asked him outright myself.
Oh, wow, yeah.
So, and when he said, yeah, no, I'd love to do it, I was like, oh my God, really? And we had sung together on that tour. He called me out, and that was another funny thing, because he said, why don't you come and sing Can't Get Enough with me?
Oh, nice.
Because when that first came out, John, it was on Top of the Pops. We had a program in the UK called Top of the Pops, mm-hmm. and Bad Company were on there playing that. And John was so proud of them, you know, because they were signing to Swan Song. We all sat around the TV and watched this, you know. So yeah. I've got very fond memories of John and Bad Company. And I told Paul this. And so during the tour, it was coming towards the end of the tour, he said, you know, why don't you come out? And I've been watching you, you know, I really want you to come and sing with me. And I thought, oh, my goodness, really? And so he said, yeah, why don't you come and sing Can't Get Enough with me? And I was like, so I was hands shaking, absolutely over the moon.
Wow.
He said, here's what we're going to do. We're going to start the song, and I want you to walk out. I'm going to sing the first bit, and then you're going to walk out, and I'm going to go, ladies and gentlemen, Deborah Bonham, and you're going to sing the next verse. And I thought, okay, that's great, except I'm such a klutz sometimes. So I'm thinking I've got to walk. I'm trying to be all cool, and I just can't do that. You know?
She's got her band lined up. She's practicing the walk.
I'm practicing the walk.
She's not practicing the singing.
No. The singing's fine.
That's second nature. Yeah. She's not worried about that at all.
Bloody hell, the walk.
It's the walking.
She's getting walking performance anxiety.
I did. I got horrible walking performance anxiety. I was convinced I was going to trip up. I was trying to figure out how I hold the mic. Paul Rodgers, I mean, let's put this out there. You've seen him. He's as cool as cool as cool.
Oh, yeah.
He stands on that stage. He throws that mic up. If I did that, well, I did it because when the guys were doing the Free Spirit stuff, I was rehearsing them. So I was doing all Paul's parts over here in the UK. And
it's just doing all Paul's parts.
Well, you know, not doing all Paul's.
Let's not get back to that.
This is Sunday morning, clean podcast TV, let me tell you. So I was playing the part of Paul Rodgers, put it that way. And I did try and throw the mic stand up, and it landed on the drummer. So, I can't do this stuff, you know. And he's so cool, you know, he just does it. And I'm like, oh. So I'm desperately trying to figure out how I'm going to walk out on stage, you know, with him. And so they're all laughing backstage. And even Paul noticed it. He's going, what's she doing? And I'm going up and down back of the stage going, yeah, I'm going to walk out like this. No, I'm going to walk out like this. And I ended up just like trotting out like a little pony with my microphone. And but at least I got the singing right. So it was good.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. So we had sung together. And so, yeah, when he came and sang on the Duchess, it was fantastic. And Jason played the drums on that one as well.
Yeah.
That was another story.
He was rehearsing with Zeppelin.
He was rehearsing with Zeppelin for the O2 reunion.
So they were having these secret rehearsals. So I'd have to go to this secret location to pick Jason up at night.
Yeah, but it was a secret that he was coming and recording with us as well.
The best time thing ever. He's like going, Uncle Pete's going to be here in 7, you know, can you guys hurry up? Yeah, I said, Jimmy, Robert, Pete will be mad if I'm late.
Yeah, can we pick up the tempo a little bit? Oh, my God.
Yeah, can you just pick me move it along. So they know they didn't know that he was coming out and like doing this with us. Yeah. It was great.
Well, I just turned up and Jimmy and Robert come out. What are you doing here?
Yeah. I'm just shooting the piece.
I just got to pick up my nephew. Yeah.
You know, that worked perfectly because Jason had played with Paul before as well. Yeah. So Jason was on the drums. And Paul and I did the vocals, which was, you know, a big moment when you're playing and singing with somebody like that who's one of your peers, you know,
yeah.
is great. It's almost like a little bit of validation that you think, okay, we must be okay if people like this will play with us.
Well, not only play, I mean, you guys became his backing band for the Free Spirit tour. So, I mean, that's complete validation right there.
Oh, yes. Pete was amazing with that. The whole band were.
Well, funny. So somebody just sent me this today. Funny enough, and it's a little quote from Paul. From it says, "Rogers tells ABC Radio that revisiting the Free material was a joy. Noting, I rediscovered how I so much enjoyed these songs, played with the right band who understand how to hit it just right." So that was us.
That is awesome.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's us all the name.
That is
stuff. So he's still talking about it today. It really was a great tour. We did the UK tour, which
it was.
Finished at the Royal Albert Hall.
It was brilliant. With it,
and they filmed and recorded that. CD and a Blu-ray and everything, and it hit the Billboard charts at number 2. So it did really well. And that was Quarter Valley Records that did that. That's how we met Quarter Valley Records, who then signed us to do the Bon & Bullock album.
Yeah.
So and then we went out to America and did the tour there as well.
So the new album. Yeah. Let's eventually hit on that. It's been an hour. Let's start talking about the new album. But
on the Duchess album, there was another great guest called Dick Parry.
Dick Parry.
It's not connected to earlier at all.
It is not.
Dick Parry is amazing. He was
Have you heard of Dick Parry? He's a saxophone player.
Pink Floyd.
Oh, okay.
And he's certainly on Dark Side of the Moon and other albums as well. That's all Dick Parry's playing. And Dick Parry, he doesn't play with anyone. He's very reclusive even back then. He's totally reclusive now, but even back then. And Jerry Shirley, the drummer from Humble Pie, who was playing with us, he was a great friend of Dick Parry's because Jerry also played with Syd Barrett and stuff like that. So,
oh, wow.
So he called Dick Parry to see if he'd do it. So we were really honoured that Dick Parry came out and joined our album, played a bit of sax on it. So that was a fantastic guest.
Well done for getting back to that. Dick definitely deserved it.
Excellent callback. Well, kind of. And then in 2016, you actually did kind of re-release For You in the Moon as Looking Back at the Moon.
Looking Back at the Moon, yeah. That's it had some of the songs off For You in the Moon and some songs that never ever made any album, not for any other reason other than it just didn't happen.
It was demos.
And I like those songs.
It was demos we'd made in the 90s.
Okay.
So we pieced them together with For You and the Moon. I think there's probably six. Was there eight songs on For You and the Moon? I think was there eight or nine songs. I think we probably left two off. So there's like seven of the For You and the Moon songs.
It was really just done.
And then five or six of the 90s songs that we had done. So. Which tied it into kind of an 80s blues rock kind of vibe.
But we did it mainly because when we were playing live, we'd do a couple of these songs that no one could ever buy. And people used to keep saying, how do we get hold of that? How do we get hold of that? And so it was really for us to sell live, that one. It was just, so people could get this song, especially a song called Heaven that everybody seemed to love. So, so that's why we did that.
Okay. How did the idea for doing an album of interpretations come about for the new album?
it really was the fact that we were talking with Quarto Valley Records, and the whole idea was to, they were going to re-release all the other albums, especially Spirit, through the, you know, the label. We were talking to Bruce Quarto, who's the head there, whose birthday it was yesterday, so I have to give him a happy birthday.
Happy birthday, Bruce.
Shout out to Bruce, because they've been fantastic with us, him and Mike Carden, who's his label's operation director, and Nina Miller. They've been great. And but they were going to just put out the Spirit album.
Words mean nothing to me, nothing to me. I'm going to set myself free. I'm going to fly.
It. Okay. And I just thought, you know what, this is so much, it's always been a band, but it was even more galvanized as a band after the Free Spirit and the American Stars Aligned tour. You know, they really are too special and too good just to be, you know, lumped in the Deborah Bonham band. It's, and we've always stuck with that because after, you know, through all the years, it's just been Deborah Bonham band.
Yeah.
But I've always wanted to have a band name. I've always wanted it to be a band name. And so after that, I said to Bruce and Mike, listen, I really want to do a new project. I don't want to just regurgitate the other stuff, you know.
Okay.
It feels like we need a new project and a band. And it felt the right time now to do that interpretations of the old blues songs. It felt the right time. And I said, let's do this. And they thought it was a great idea. And we changed the name to Bonham Bullock. And that's how it came around, really, isn't it?
The songs span like 7 decades.
Yeah.
How did you guys choose this song? I mean, was it intentionally to go through that big sort of span of time?
Started off with about 100 songs, probably, because we had lots of people contributing ideas. So we had a guy who was helping manage us at the time, Gary Nesbitt, he contributed a lot of the songs. Roy Williams, who's a great friend of ours, who was he helped us with the John Bonham Memorial statue. He was Robert Plant's sound engineer, Roy.
Oh, okay.
Sadly died years ago, right at the beginning of the pandemic and all that, so cancer got him. But he contributed a lot and recommended a lot of songs. Robert Plant recommended a bunch. Debbie recommended a bunch. And so we ended up with a mass of at least 100 songs.
Wow.
Oh, and Marco, one of the drummers on the album, Marco Giovino, he contributed a few as well. So Debbie eventually whittled it down to 13 songs. So it was just random that they spanned 7 decades.
It wasn't random.
You didn't choose them because of the era. You choose the songs because...
Oh, I see what you mean. But saying that, I really just didn't want to do an album of all the old classics that everybody's done. And right. You know, there's some versions out there. I didn't want to do that. I really wanted to have something contemporary on there as well and a little bit obscure. So I was looking for that.
Okay.
The fact that I found it, yes, is random. I wouldn't have just picked it because it was contemporary and... I wouldn't have picked it just for that. The song resonated. So, yeah, things like Mark Lanegan, who was the singer with the Screaming Trees.
Oh, yeah.
There's a song.
I love Mark Lanegan. I actually got to know him over the past couple of years. He was on the podcast. We kind of stayed in touch. Yeah.
Oh, Craigie. We've never spoken to him. We had hoped to meet him.
Well, we wanted to get the version of Bleeding Muddy Water to him, you know. And then he sadly passed away, and it was
three, four weeks ago. That was quite a that was quite a shock.
Yeah, and that was very, very, very sad.
Yeah,
and what a talent. And so Bleeding Muddy Water, and that was off his Blues Funeral album.
Yeah.
To me, it's a pivotal moment on the new album. I absolutely love Bleeding Muddy Water. And it was a challenge to find our way to do it. But I knew from when I first heard it that I thought that we could do a version and bring our personality and our heart and soul to it, you know. And for me, on the whole album, I mean, there's a few moments on the album where I think, yeah, like Trouble Blues, the Sam Cooke song, that's a big moment for me on the new album.
You've just picked my two favorite songs off the album.
So many days since you went away, I often think of you night and day. But I know that someday.
There you go. Well, they're the two, you know, they really, for me, they're the ones that make me go like this, you know.
Well, it comes because through for sure.
Bleeding Muddy Water, it just, I listen to it, and every time I listen to it, I just think, yeah, you know, it was a moment.
Yeah.
So, yeah, thank you.
I also love When It Don't Come Easy and The Changeling. Peter, you're the solo on The Changeling, it's just, that solo is just so beautiful. All right.
Isn't it?
Well, I follow BJ Cole. Starts off with BJ Cole doing a pedal steel.
Yeah.
And then I sort of come in. I think I sort of basically repeated some of BJ's melody that he made up in that solo, and then expanded on that.
Take the credit. You really did do a beautiful solo.
Yeah, I like to be able to hum a tune, you know. And you know, and BJ's so melodic as well, and it was love, and it was special because it's a very special song, that as well. Bit like he's almost like a Mark Lanegan character as well, Chris Wilson. He's a tragic character as well.
Is
that
he?
Died a couple of years. Yeah, so they're just quite a responsibility to do their songs
huge.
And be
huge,
and be utmost respectful
and bring
to them and mean something,
to
mean something afterwards is,
yeah.
You know, rather than, you know, when just picking up the paycheck or what's that expression, phoning it in,
yeah.
Yeah, this album definitely wasn't any of that, whereas a lot of covers albums, they phone it in, don't they? They get a karaoke backing track and sing over it, and it's like,
yeah.
No point. We spent more time and more pain and more effort on this probably than our own songs.
And when we eventually finished the mixing, we were sat here around this table, and our friend who's actually sat outside at the moment, who's staying the weekend, and there was a few friends, and we put on the album. But when it got to the end, and the end of The Changeling, which is the last track on the album, tears were streaming down my face.
Oh.
And I'd forgotten that this was us, that this album was us.
Wow.
I was just listening to it thinking, you know, it was very, very emotional, wasn't it? Because it is other people's songs. It is their babies. It is, you know, we had to pay that respect. Yeah. And I think we got there. And I know that the fact that if I can sit there and get emotional listening back, then that's it. That's the moment. And I think, yeah, okay, we've done the job.
You've done the job.
Because if I don't get that, if I don't feel that, it's a waste of time.
Yeah, you've done the job of paying respect to the artist, but also making the songs your own.
Yeah.
Which I love.
Yeah. And it definitely, it moved me. And when I played it all back and we sat here, it moved everybody around the table. I looked round and our friend was tears was in his face, and our other friend, he was getting all emotional, and we were just listening to it, and I thought, yeah, we've done this.
Were there any tracks on the album that kind of surprised you when you did it, like either how it came out compared to the original, or maybe
Trouble Blues?
Oh, okay.
Trouble Blues. I mean, that's completely, completely different. When we were in the studio, we started doing it, and it just wasn't working for me. I stood there and I was like, yeah, when you take on a Sam Cooke song, which was me, I chose this. I wanted to do Sam Cooke. Mm-hmm. Goodness knows why, because I knew that this was going to be the biggest. I was going to walk around in all up tight, because it's Sam Cooke,
Yeah.
And we started doing it, and I just thought, no, this isn't working. And I thought, stick with it, Deb. See if there's another way that we bring the band to it. So I got everybody to stop playing. And I just said to drummer Marco Giovino, who's an amazing drummer, played with Band of Joy, Emmy Lou Harris, Nora Jones, just really, really great drummer. And I said, just me and you, just play a straight drum, straight 4-4 drum beat, slow, and let me sing it a cappella. And as soon as I did it, I looked at the band and they were down in the studio part, and I was singing through the glass on the microphone. Mm-hmm. And I just saw them all go, yes, that's it. And it worked. And so that was the basis of then Pete doing his real haunting guitar at the front end of it. And it just grew. I think that was the one that was possibly I thought it was going to be the most difficult, and it turned out to be the biggest difference to the original, but it's a great difference. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And on an album where you're doing other people's songs, how is it difficult to sequence because you haven't written them? And is it any different from trying to sequence your own album?
No, I mean, I'm used to writing set lists and sequencing. It took me a while to sequence it, but I think you've got to have in a set list when we're on stage, isn't it? You've got to have light and shade. Yeah. You can't have it all being low and, flat or everything in the same key, the first four or five tracks. You've got to move it so that they segue. And I was listening to an interview with Peter Gabriel about how he sequenced the So album.
Okay.
And literally, he just kept going from the back of one end, back of one song and the front of another, and piecing them together to see how they went into each other. And it's exactly what we did, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly that.
Paul Rogers would do that as well with a set list.
Yeah.
He'd spend a lot of time
doing
the back end of one song and the start of the next to see how they, what's key. But
same with Robert, I was talking to Robert Plant about that how a set list works.
A lot of thought goes into that.
You really have to, you've got to keep the audience there, and you need to move the set list so that you have high points and low points, because you don't want it all in your face all the time. And it's
funny enough with Led Zeppelin, the Rock and Roll off Set 4, that song, you'd think that would normally be somebody's encore, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
And the Zeppelin were amazing. Well, they opened up with that song, didn't they?
Yeah. That's true.
They opened up with the encore. So from the get go, it was like, oh, gosh.
Yep.
Yeah.
Pedal to the metal.
Yeah, but then they drop it down to Rain song or No Quarter.
Yeah.
So you had this up there, then you drop down, and then you go back up. And it's a musical journey, for the audience. So it is very important.
Yeah, you don't want things to be a transition to be too jarring. So,
no, exactly.
So, and this is the first time that you've produced an entire album, right, Deborah?
Yeah.
So how did that come about?
Because I wanted to.
Okay, there you go. Easy enough.
I think I better go and have a little lie down while she answers this.
Come back. Where's he disappearing to? Where's he gone?
He actually did leave. He's gone.
He's
gone. He just walked in the back room.
What did you do? Tell your story.
What's he doing? So rude. This is what I have to put up with. That's what he did on the album. You see, he kept getting up and going, "Can I go to the pub now? Have I finished?" He's come to plug us. He's about to plug us in because we're about to lose the connection.
No! I'm keeping you guys forever. I'm sorry about that.
Production, it just got to that point, as a band, we know each other inside out. And I just know exactly what where they can go, the height that they can take it.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody else knows that really, and unless you've really played with the guys for all these years. And the band, we've all been together as a band for a long, long time. And they brought that, you know, it wasn't me solely. I didn't tell them what to do, as in the parts and everything. I nurture them. I had to learn diplomacy, which was very interesting.
I've gone and broken that bloody string. I've had that since new.
I've had it since you were a kid.
You just are not interested in this production business, are you?
Just yet another moment in my life where she gets to tell me what to do.
I didn't. But it's about bringing the best out of someone. I learned that. You know, there were times where I just thought, can you just shut up and play the chord? Just play the chord. But I didn't say that, you know. I just said, maybe you could just go a little bit better. And he gave the tempo and came back and just went, yeah, and played it, you know. So, yeah, it was just the right time.
Richie Blackmore played one of his best guitar solos when he was in a filthy mood and hated everybody.
Wouldn't that happen quite often in his bands, though? Didn't he hate everybody a lot?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the guitar solo in a song called Hold On the Stormbringer album.
Oh, okay.
Check his solo out there.
I
don't think our band is quite like that. But anyway, it made sense to do this. I just didn't want to bring anybody else in. I just thought, no, as much as it's been great working with other people, they bring their own thing. You've got their baggage with it as well and all of their ideas. And sometimes that can be great. But when you know where you want to go with something, we're at that stage now, you know.
Yeah.
So it just made sense for me to do it. And it was hard work. It was much harder than I thought it was going to be. And it was a massive challenge.
Yes.
But actually, I loved it. And I'd do it all day long going forward.
And then you brought up Peter Gabriel. You did send it to his place to have it mixed and mastered, though.
And I think
Robert mentioned that, didn't he, Robert Plant?
He did. See, the problem that had happened, we'd recorded it and everything was sounding fantastic, but the mixes just weren't doing it for me.
Okay.
I wanted this space around every instrument, and I wanted it all to breathe. I didn't want it all squashed up and sounding, you know, compressed almost, all of that.
Yes.
And I was playing it to Robert, and I just said, yeah, I'm just not happy with the mixes. I need to find somebody. And he instantly recommended Tim Oliver at Peter Gabriel's Real World.
Okay.
And he said they don't just take anyone. They're very choosy about what they take, but give him a call because I think he'll love it.
Wow.
And I rang Tim and we sent it to Tim, and he said, yeah, I would really love to do it. And I was so thrilled.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Instantly. We had to do it remotely because for the pandemic, you know, so I couldn't, Pete and I couldn't go there for the first lot. So we sent it to him. He did it, sent it back. And I felt at one point, I felt I was the most pickiest, you know, because I was going back saying, can you, you know, that hi-hat there, can we have just that down a bit? And he tolerated me so well. Honestly, he was brilliant with me. You know, he was never condescending to me, never disagreed. He was just great. And then he brought his amazing talent to it. And we played it we eventually then got a day that we could go to Real World. The restrictions were lifted somewhat. And so Pete and I went down there. It was fantastic, wasn't it? It really was great.
Yeah.
And we just did the final bits and then it came back. And we sat around the table and I honestly, he just did it exactly how I heard it, which was just fantastic. So, yeah, Tim Oliver, what a talent.
That is awesome. Now, I've seen some UK tour dates for you guys. Is there any plans to maybe take this over to the States at some point?
Hopefully
we'll be back in the States. It's probably looking more like spring next year,
okay.
if not the end of this year.
Can we go in the fall, please?
It'd be nice, yeah. At the minute, we're between agents, as they say. So
we actually need an agent out in America. That's what we want. We want somebody to bring us out there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because we did the 2018 Stars Align, then we came back in 2019, played the Cutting Room in New York, Daryl Hall's place upstate, and Levon Helms.
Wow.
Up in Woodstock. which was fantastic. So, and then the idea was that we the album would come out in 2020 and we tour, but of course the pandemic happened. So we sat back, we agreed with Quarto Valley that, you know, the best thing was just to wait. You know, we'd come this far and we were so happy with the album that they wanted us to wait a bit. We were right. So now the album comes out on the 29th of April. And yeah, we really want to come out to America because it was so, great. Those, you know, when we came out. So we're hoping that that's going to happen. In the meantime, we are playing the UK and we're playing Europe as well.
Okay.
France and Belgium and Netherlands.
Yeah. So we start at the end of this month and then we're playing right through for right up to the end of September.
Wow. That's pretty extensive.
Well, it's quite a nice way of doing it. We're going out for about...
It's not solid.
We're going out for about 3 years, then we're back home for a week or two. Oh. We go back out for each other. It's Europe and UK. It's not like the States.
That's true. Yeah, the next gig is an overnight drive, and you end up in Reno.
Yeah.
That was funny.
We did have a great time.
It was the Blues Brothers, honestly, the chicken wire. I couldn't believe it. And we'd just been at the House of Blues, you know, plush velvet and everything, you know.
And it was the only gig where a fight broke out.
Oh, of course. No doors in the toilets.
And after a long journey on a tour bus where you're not allowed to use the toilet for certain numbers, when you burst into that Reno toilet and there's no door,
some fan comes walking past me
and the door
goes, sat on the loo.
Goes, hey, hi, how you doing?
You in the bed?
Hey, hi, how you doing?
Oh man.
I still remember that expression. It was, hey, hi, how you doing?
Yeah, I'm sure you will never forget it.
Triple greetings in a row. It was like, hey, hi, how you doing?
Hey, hi, how you doing? It was obvious about how you were doing, wasn't it? While you were sat there.
Hey, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah. Yeah, you can pass me that paper.
Yeah. Who are you here to see?
Oh, dear.
Man, did you guys play Ghost Riders in the Sky for like 30 minutes straight? Well, I'm hoping you guys can come over to America. I'm just outside DC, so I would love to see you guys. It would just be such an awesome show.
Our friend DC is just outside here.
Yeah, we call him DC.
You're just outside DC, and DC's just outside here. You may as well...
Hello, DC. He's an Ohio boy.
He's from Ohio.
Nice. Well, I won't hold that against him, but...
And his hair's gone silver, so he's a bit Ohio silver lining.
Oh, man. Somehow I feel like I just walked into it and I don't even know it.
That was a good one.
You're everywhere with nowhere, baby.
Jeff Beck will not speak to you again. Stop it. Oh,
no. Jeff Beck is quoted as saying about that song, because when we did the Stars Aligned Tour in America with Paul Rodgers and Free Spirit, and Ann Wilson was on the bill, and Jeff Beck was on the bill as well.
Yeah.
And it's quite a package tour that was. But I'd heard that he wouldn't do Hi-Ho Silver Lining on tour. He wouldn't play it live.
Really?
And I'd heard that he had said that, somebody asked about Hi-Ho Silver Lining, and he said, it's been like wearing a pink toilet seat round my neck all my life.
Just shame he wasn't in Reno, wasn't it? He could have lent you that seat.
Yeah. I said, just a pink toilet door would do me, thanks.
Yeah. And a seat in the door would have been good.
Well, there wasn't a right seat in the house.
Oh, ba-dum-bum, tish.
Ba-dum-bum-bish, yeah. So, we'd love to see you, and it'd be great if we could come and play DC. We've never been there, so that would be absolutely fantastic.
Oh, a lot of great places to play, but where can people pick up the album and follow you guys? Is there social media presence?
Well, there's the social media. There's Deborah Bonham Facebook. There's the deborahbonham.com website, which has all the links to all the social medias. There's as our YouTube channel and stuff like that. And the Quarter Valley Records site. So the record's going to be released on CD and all the digital platforms and streaming services and everything. So the single is released this week, isn't it? 25th of March.
Friday it comes out. Can't You See What You're Doing To Me as a single.
Yeah. And then the album April 29th, which will be available everywhere.
The whole Bonham Bullock thing is, if you type that in, it goes straight to Deborah Bonham anyway. So
Okay. We've
linked it all up. It's just that the website and the socials have all always been Deborah Bonham. So we've kept it as that. And Bonham Bullock links straight away to it.
Oh, perfect.
I do have a Peter Bullock Facebook page which is usually a brag the odd time, and then I do a bunch of stupid things as well, and I'll stick a picture up of it, so it's a bit of a...
I'm going to follow it immediately. Once we're done here, I'm on it.
Actually, his page is completely bonkers.
you can see how rubbish I am at cooking and driving.
Oh, hey, that sounds like fun.
Yeah.
I'm in. You've got my attention now.
Fantastic. And hopeless DIY projects. And
he's always featuring...
Hopeless cookery projects, but always involves chili sauce to disguise everything.
He's always featuring his ass as well, he calls it. It's our donkey, our rescued donkey.
Oh. So
it always features Pete's ass. He's well known in Reno.
See... Everything's coming back to dicks and ass.
Yeah.
Well, guys, I've kept you so long. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time. It's been awesome talking with you.
Thanks, Mark. Well,
who do we invoice for that time?
John Lennon. John Lappin.
Yeah.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.